Good morning. On behalf of the community of Eastern Mennonite Seminary who regularly gathers here, we welcome all of you from the broader community as we join today in a service of worship and learning. You are welcome in the name of God, the God of compassion and of justice, in the name of Jesus Christ, murdered by the powers and raised again, and by the Holy Spirit who broods over creation and this place, convicting and healing. Welcome.
And as we begin, we want to recognize that something huge is at play in the context of our country today that will on many levels affect the ongoing view of others, embrace or divide. A collective anxiety that's at play that feeds into the political dehumanization of others in words and actions. So just note that for a moment as we enter into this time of worship and be present and entrusted to the Spirit who is with us. And I invite us as we move through our worship time today just to pay attention to the words of the Spirit, with the words of Jesus, the laments, and the invitation to a response. Let us gather together in this way in worship.
You know that in the world, the recognized rulers lord it over their subjects, and their great men make them feel the weight of authority. This is not the way with you. Whoever wants to be great must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be willing to be a slave to all.
He began to say to his disciples first, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. Whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in private rooms shall be proclaimed upon the housetops."
At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a little child to him and placed a child among them. And he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like the little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea."
I have the honor to introduce Tom Doyle to you today. Father Doyle, who prefers to be called Tom, is a world-renowned Catholic leader, the leading victim advocate within the Catholic Church, a priest, a canon lawyer, an addictions therapist, and a longtime supporter of justice and compassion for clergy sex abuse victims. Over the last couple of days, I've gotten to know Tom. And one of the things that he said is that when he was introduced yesterday morning at the faculty, staff, administrator seminar, that the greatest accolade of all is when a victim tells him, "Thank you. Nobody else has listened to me, and you have come." The humility, the integrity, the wisdom that Tom has to offer us is a great gift, that he traveled here, that he took time away from very important legal cases where he is working on behalf of victims. So it's a great honor for our community to host him. Thank you, Tom, for being here.
Thank you. Let me just say that being here with you is just as important, if not more so in many ways, than working in the courts, because it's an opportunity to share with you and join with you in confronting what I think has been the greatest challenge to Christian leadership and the leadership of other denominations in centuries. Because it's not only challenging us, our leaders especially, our systems, our theology, but it's challenging the secular institutions as well, colleges, universities, schools, hospitals, businesses. It's challenging them because it's forcing them to respond honestly to what really is our duty to these people whom we serve. For those of us who are in any way involved in religious life, denominations, whether we're just out there traveling on our own or whether we're part of an organized denomination, this issue has theological overtones, undertones, and middle tones. It has the same for the secular institutions. Take a look at what happened in Penn State a couple of years ago. Now, what's the theological meaning of what happened at Penn State? The theological meaning of what happened at Penn State was to illustrate quite clearly that there is only one God, and that God is not football. Oftentimes, we get confused, our institutions get confused, and are severely challenged, and react in an equally severe way to those who challenge the institution, who challenge our approach and our application of our theology, who challenge us or those who want to call us and say, "Look it, this is what the scriptures say. This is what we read this morning. Is that real? Is it a fairy tale? Do we believe that or do we follow that?" Just before we came in, I said something, I told a story to Kevin about a seminar I was in on about 15 years ago, and I'll just repeat the story to add a little levity to things, because this is kind of a heavy topic. In 2002, I was in Boston, and I was involved in a conference, and I was part of a two-person panel, myself and another man, who was a theologian specializing in medieval theology. And he was talking about some of the medieval popes and the effects that these individuals had on the life and the process of the church through the ages. And he was focusing in on Pope Boniface VIII, who was an interesting character. He lived in the 12th century. And Boniface VIII would have preferred, well, he did prefer, a gold-gilt monarchy to the Christian community, and he made that clear with his actions. But one of his important statements, papal encyclical, whatever you want to call it, I'm not sure what type it was at the time, in one of those, he ended it by saying that it is the divine will that every creature be subject to the authority of the Supreme Roman Pontiff. I was asked to respond, and my first response was, Boniface VIII never had a cat. The dissonance that we have is something that's horrific if you think about it for a moment. Christian churches, and this difficulty of sexual abuse isn't something that's limited to one or the other denomination or one or the other geographic area. What I've learned is that it's endemic, it's all over, and there are two parts to it. One is the actual violation of persons by someone else, and usually we're focusing on persons. The violators are men or women in power, in authority, and they prey on either children, minors, or young women or young men. But those people are vulnerable because there's a distinct power imbalance. So therefore, you have one big problem we have in our theology is power, the use and abuse of power. Why is it there? So that's one part. The other part is the way the institutional leaders respond to when they receive information about sexual abuse of one of their own by one of their own. And the common response of the Christian churches has been nothing short of horrifically scandalous. And the disharmony between this response and the things that we have read here this morning, the disharmony is deafening. Now, what I'm talking about is when the victim, the person preyed upon, suddenly becomes a tremendous threat to this institution that has vowed itself to follow the way of Christ. It becomes a threat to this institution, and then the institution, the leadership, they have to look into their own actions and say, okay, this theology that we're based on, do we have a right now to twist it around and turn it or turn it off for a little while we respond? And are we really all about saving our institution, our structures, and our security? Is that more important than this one individual? So can we take that one verse in the scriptures and turn it off for this instance? And that's what's been happening. And that's why the churches have gotten in deep, deep trouble. Now, I was ordained a Catholic priest in 1970, and I never even was able to imagine or dream then what I would experience in the years that I was in ministry. Never, ever. And I got into the issue of sexual abuse because I was deep on the inside. I was trained as a lawyer, church lawyer, and I was working in the Vatican Embassy in Washington, D.C. Little factoid for you, the Roman Catholic Church is also considered equal to a country called the Holy See. And it's all over the place. It's got a little area in the middle of Rome called the Vatican. But it's considered a country. It's part of the United Nations. It's listed. And it has a diplomatic corps, just like the United States and other countries do. And it has ambassadors called nuncios, which is the Latin word for an ambassador, and about 120 countries. And then where it doesn't have an ambassador, where the country does not have diplomatic relations with the Vatican, it has what's called an apostolic delegate or a representative to the Catholic Church in the area. Now, that's difficult for me to wrap my brain around, even though I worked in the office, why a church needs to have diplomatic relations with a country. Because it's not a country. It's a denomination. It's a church. It's a religion. While I was there in 1984, I was asked to follow this horrific case that nobody knew about in Lafayette, Louisiana. But it had come to our attention because a set of parents refused $300,000 to keep quiet about what happened to their little boy and instead obtained the services of an attorney who blatantly told them, "You are being shafted. You need to go to court." And for the first time in history, as far as I know, a couple sued the Roman Catholic Church in the civil court for the sexual violation of their son. And this particular priest admitted when he was in a hospital at one point, he served 10 years in prison, that he had probably violated at least 500 young boys. He was a true pedophile. So every one of his victims was a prepubescent boy. That's how I got started. And it was part of my business for me for a while. And the while lasted only a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, while I still wanted to protect the church, which was the hierarchy and the governmental system. And that all changed when I met one of the victims, a 10-year-old boy. I mentioned this last night, and I think the other day too, in the morning. When I looked into this boy who was one of this priest's victims and saw this absent, vacant look, it has haunted me ever since. And since that time, I've met a number of victims, and that changed the course of my life. When it became a human problem, not just papers on my desk with numbers that go into a file that has another number, with more papers being passed around. But that is, in a sense, one of the major mistakes we've made. We've tried to turn our living theology into an administrative action. And we've tried to solve this, or the leadership in many places has tried to solve this serious problem with administrative remedies and not human remedies. One of the worst of these administrative remedies is worrying about the existence of the institution. Churches are institutions. Sometimes it takes us a while to realize that because we're used to our own congregation, our own parish. We don't necessarily need to see the bigger picture, and we're probably much better off not seeing the bigger picture. If you're a Catholic, you're constantly reminded about the Pope in Rome and the bishops and all this. But basically, church is, like Mayor Daley said about politics, all politics are local. Church is local, your congregation, your school, your parish. But the institution that represents the meaning of all of this, of Christ's life to the world, to the country, the culture. So this institution has not been doing it right. What it's been doing is turning the obligation upside down. And the victim suddenly becomes a tremendous threat and is stiff-armed, is ignored, is put off, is lied to, is treated as the enemy. I can't tell you how many instances I've known of victims who simply wanted to sit down with the bishop, the president of the university, the leader of the religious order, and explain to them what has happened. But they are not allowed. Or they're allowed to come in, but in the presence of the guy's lawyer. So all of a sudden, what we find has been happening is our churches, mine especially, the Catholic Church, has been subcontracting the Gospels out to the attorneys. And so when you approach a bishop or a church leader, they'll say, "Talk to my lawyers." Now, Christ never said that, and he never implied that to anybody. In fact, the only individuals in his life that he ever got angry with were the leadership of the churches because of their hypocrisy. That's pretty clear. And there's no way, no matter how good a scripture scholar you are, to sandpaper that out of existence and change the meaning of that. So we have a problem then with our theology actually enabling the abusers, those who violate. It enables them because all of a sudden the theology of church becomes directed at institution, and the hierarchy of values is turned upside down, where the institution, and oftentimes institution doesn't even mean the entire body of Mennonites or the entire body of Catholics. It means the governing class, the ruling class. There's a very solid principle in political science that a ruling elite, that's the guys that run the show, before long are going to identify the needs of the masses of the group with their own needs and vice versa. So when I've heard the term, we do this for the good of the church, I know what it means. It means for my good, for our good, not your good. Because the good of the church involves not just the victims, their mothers, their fathers, their friends, their families, those who are hurt with them, the collateral damage. It's difficult to put into practice and to walk the walk when it's so challenging that it involves our own internal systems. It's amazing how we can talk about justice and peace, and we can take care of people in other countries and in other parts of the world and fight for them and argue for them, but when it comes to justice and peace within our own system, when it's the men and the women, mostly the men in my case, who have violated these people and violated their sense of peace and justice, it's very challenging. We're afraid to deal with that. We're afraid to talk to the victims. We're afraid to acknowledge what has happened to them, and we're doubly afraid to acknowledge that we have messed it up because of our self-centeredness, our self-serving approach and understanding of church, that we are so important that we must be protected at all costs. These, I think, are revelations. What's happened in the churches are revelations from the higher power to them, telling them, you guys better clean your act up because you're not doing it right. And for centuries, this issue of sexual abuse has existed in the churches. The Catholic Church came into existence, according to our history, in the year zero, and it's been around since then. And it has been the main Christian church, the largest and the oldest, and it has acknowledged this particular issue of men of the cloth sexually preying on others throughout its history. There's a long, detailed, documented history. And at each phase of that history, when it has become publicly known, and there's been a long period of public knowledge, it has tried to control it in a number of ways. But it has never been successful at doing that. This, in our era, this whole phenomenon of sexual abuse, which became public in the middle 80s, it was always there. It was not too deep underneath the surface. But the cover of secrecy was ripped off by the media and then by the attorneys. They ripped the lid off, and there it was. And we had to deal with it. And the institutions didn't know what to do. And I was in the middle of that, not knowing what to do. We tried denial. It's not really happening. We tried minimizing. It's just a few bad apples. We tried shifting the blame. It's people that are dissenters and sort of heretics that don't really have that kind of faith. Then we tried, as I said, shifting the blame, minimizing, then devaluing the messengers and the victims themselves. I read letters all the time in the work I do in the courts about bishops and how they write to another guy and their staff about somebody who came in and reported sexual abuse. And I was doing a case the other day where the pastor who had sexually abused boys, he repeatedly had them staying overnight in the rectory. But what touched things off is a woman's husband was buried, and she went back to visit his grave a couple days later, and the grave had been plowed over. Even it was gone. So she said, you know, that's kind of a shocker. So she went to the pastor and complained. And they had these plans to redo the cemetery somehow or other, and somebody sort of forgot to tell her that once he's in the ground, he's not going to be there very long. Now, that's desecration of sacred ground as far as I'm concerned. So she wrote to the bishop, and the bishop gave the letter to his vicar general, the second in command, to answer, you take care of this. So the guy wrote back to the bishop. This is an inner office memo All he said in there was this woman and her husband had been in what the Catholic Church calls an invalid marriage for 40 years. They hadn't been married by a priest. They'd been an invalid marriage. They had children. They had grandchildren. That had nothing at all to do with the issue. And so that's shifting the blame. That's one way to do it. So we've got problems that have come up in our theology. One is prioritizing the victim, no matter how that person is victimized, and now we're talking sexual victimization, becomes or should become the center of importance, the focus. That person needs to be healed, needs to be met with compassion, with understanding, and not with lawyers. We need to rethink, I think, the denominations all need to rethink their ecclesiology, their meaning of church. Church started off as a way of life for people following Christ. And they had the only structure they had were the chairs they sat on when they went to their services in somebody's house. And it became structured and it became official over the centuries. And it became, and Christ in many ways became lost in the administrative details. Church is people. Our Second Vatican Council redefined it, saying church is the people of God. They didn't say it's the clerics of God or the bishops of God or the nuns of God. It's the people of God. And in our denomination, the clerics of God happen to constitute 0.00074% of the total. So you have this 1.15 billion people being run by approximately 2,800 celibate male bishops. Now, one of our problems is that the lack of appreciation for the sexual abuse by the clergy is the fact that the leadership are all celibate. None of them are parents. They don't have clue one what it means to be a parent, what goes through a mother or father's heart when they find out their child has been sexually violated, especially by one whom they trust implicitly with everything, their priest. So we have to be committed, I think, to learning. And if we don't take this commitment seriously, there are other sources of power that are going to force us to do it, the civil courts. And in our denomination's case, the civil courts came into play a couple of decades ago, for one reason only, that the ecclesiastical authorities, the bishops and their staffs, did not do what they should have done when they were approached by the victims and their parents. These men and women who went to report what happened to their children were listened to politely, we'll take care of it, go home and say a prayer. They were encouraged not to say anything for the good of the church, and if they persisted, they became the enemy. They were lied to, they were stiff-armed, they were manipulated, and the encouragement to remain quiet in some instances went to threats. You'll be excommunicated if you report this, because that's an excommunication, it's a sin against the priest, and it's a sin against the church, all of which are total lies. But that's what was used in my denomination. Now, I've worked with other denominations as well, and the same approach is happening. Hence, the families went to a lawyer. And the lawyers that have represented the victims, from my experience, have done what the clergy should have done. Embraced them, believed them, supported them, been their friend, been there with them to find justice. And unlike the church's lawyers, who are on an hourly basis, an hourly rate, that can go anywhere from $150 to $780 an hour, and when you call up to say, hi, how you doing, the meter starts. And that's going to cost you $25 minimum. The church lawyers take these cases on contingency. And I've known a number of men who became committed to the cause. And they mortgaged themselves up to the hilt to take these early cases, knowing that if the case fails, they're done. And one guy said, he said, I know, I got to get ready for another job, because if this goes, I'm finished. So they went to the courts, but the courts have turned out to be the one power the churches cannot control or overcome. Hence, we are where we are today. And I never thought, when I first got involved in this nightmare, that I would see what I've seen, where this little group of people, the victims, and they're the ones who are driving the bus now. It's not the leadership. I know there are issues here on this campus, and I can say, I think, with some authority, that it's not the leadership of the university that's driving this bus. It's the victims and their supporters. And in the end, what will happen here will be the same that has happened in other denominations, where they are the ones, because they have something, and we've said this in our case, we don't have, the victims don't have money, they don't have expensive attorneys, they don't have big bank accounts, they don't have public relations firms, but they do have, as one man said, we do have something the bishops don't have, and that's the truth. And the truth is, a church man or woman cannot sexually violate one of the members of the community, or anybody for that matter, and get away with it. That is not just a sin, and it's very easy to isolate it as a sin, because then all you get to do is fool around with forgiveness, twist forgiveness around a little bit, and the sinner gets off the hook, and the victim is left holding the bag, without accountability, without justice, without anything. But it's also a crime. It's a crime in every state in our country for an adult to violate a child. It's a crime for an adult to violate another adult. When you have the issue of power imbalance, it's very, very clear. And that's what happens. Theologically, what this has revealed, I think, are just a few things. It's not very complicated. It's revealed that we really must live a different understanding of what church means. It's revealed that we must treat the leadership, the pastors, the bishops, the elders, the teachers, not as if they're on some sort of a pedestal with a lot of power that they can use to manipulate and use, which we do. I mean, that power goes with the territory. So it's up to the leadership to use that to help and for growth and not for hindrance. So it's a lot of that clericalism, which is a terrible virus, a lot of the clericalism in the churches is enabled by the lay people. It's enabled by the lay people who are more clericalized in some states, some instances, than the priests or the bishops. Now, why do I say that? And I say this partly because of my own self-examination and my own spiritual journey. In the churches, we have two tiers. We have the leadership on one level. No matter how simple that is, it's still there. And on the other level, we have the masses of the believers. In our case, we have a very clearly defined clerical caste that in our church law says was ordained and divine and set up by divine will. So the Almighty said, I need clerics in my body of Christ. Now, I don't know when he said that. Probably whispered it someday when he was, you know, out of the office. But that's what the claim is. The clerics are by divine will instituted. So therefore, you have the basis of clericalism, and that disease sets up a chasm between the believers and the representatives of the Lord. And that chasm, oftentimes, the currency in the caste is power. And the power gets misused drastically. So you have this, and we've got to remember that if we teach, which I don't think you do in your denomination, but others do, that salvation comes through our participation in the organized community. In the Catholic sense, we have sacraments, and we are told we need the sacraments for salvation, and the priests are in charge of all the sacraments. So the position of every Catholic layperson who gets a sacrament is passive dependent. These guys own them, they take care of them, they're in charge of them. And I was one of these guys, so I know how that power works. So there's that, and there's the feeling that if our leadership, if the clergy or the elders are called into question for this, it's going to rock my personal boat. It's going to challenge my own emotional security because they have been guiding my spiritual development. They've been answering the questions. They've been giving me the guidance and helping me decide what to do. And that forces us to become adults. I've often said that I firmly believe that the greatest challenge to a bishop, and probably in your instance to the elders, but maybe less so, greatest challenge to a bishop is an adult Catholic. Not just one who's chronologically an adult, but who's an adult up here and an adult here, who doesn't believe in the two-tiered approach, that when we stand here, we're on an even playing field, and I'm going to tell you what I think. And if I say something you don't agree with, you can't tell me I have weak faith. I was asked one day by a bishop years ago, because of the work I'd done with victims, "Tom, when did you lose your faith?" And I looked at him and I said, "I didn't lose it, Bishop. It was redirected. The targets were redirected away from you guys to something else." And so challenging the institution is often defined as heresy, dissent, losing one's faith. But rooting out sexual abuse has nothing to do with any of that. It has a lot to do with peace and with justice. And it has a lot to do, I think, with really realizing what your faith is supposed to be grounded in. You know, it's not grounded in looking good or public image or deference. It's grounded in what is right. Two things that I think we have to acknowledge that are detrimental to any church, Christian church, responding in a Christian way to this matter, this issue. One is the misuse of the concept of forgiveness. We are a forgiving church. That's a cop-out. That means that the perpetrator can go and say, "I'm sorry I did this," be given a blessing, get absolution, whatever, and told, "Do it no more," say a prayer, and he goes off. And the victim is told, "We forgive. We're taught to forgive." She's supposed to forget. This happened. Move on. Put it behind you. Forgiveness does not equal accountability. And forgiveness is perverted and intentionally misused by any church authorities who use it as an excuse to sidestep the accountability that must be imposed on the perpetrator and on the institution that enabled him. And coupled with that is the terrible, terrible problem of secrecy. Secrecy surrounds organized religions, because in the earliest days, in the primitive times, the secrecy was part and parcel of it all. The holy man, whoever he was, that walked into the temple and communicated with the gods, that was all secret, what was going on in there. The Holy of Holies. In the Orthodox churches, the screens are closed, and the services, the mass takes place behind these screens. You can't see, you can hear it, but you can't see it. So the secrecy, I belong to a denomination where secrecy almost became a sacrament. And there was a secrecy and a paranoia with letting anyone know what's going on inside. Well, what are we supposed to have to hide? We shouldn't. And that secrecy has been a major downfall. And that secrecy preserves elitism, it protects perpetrators, and it re-victimizes victims. In conclusion, as I said, the theological issues are simple. The most important one, I think, is the meaning of the concept of church and the people in it. Church is people, not dogma, not hymns, not fancy vestments. Well, you don't have that. Not beautiful buildings, not authority, not power. It's people. And the important people among the people are those who most need Christ's love. And you think about it. You know, we have this thing in the Catholic Church called canonization, which is like you're promoted to five-star general. You're the church, the bishop, the pope says, so-and-so's in heaven. Taking that metaphor, the only human being who was personally canonized by God, by Christ, was, when I've asked that before, the common answer is the Virgin Mary. Uh-uh. It was a convicted criminal named Dismas, who was on the cross with him. That's an interesting story. It's fascinating what it says about what we are about. It fits right in with the rest of them. The first shall go last, the last shall go first. You know, don't go making a big deal out of yourself if you're one of the leaders, because you may not necessarily get in. But this guy does. All he wanted to do was be acknowledged. So the secrecy stuff has to go. The elitism has to go. And we have to remember this. We can talk about this stuff till we're blue in the face. We can give lectures about it and sermons about it. But tomorrow, if somebody comes forward and knocks on the door of the president of this university and says, I want to talk to you because I was sexually abused by one of the professors, what's she going to do or he going to do? There's only one acceptable response. Welcome. Come on in. Let's talk. Forget about the lawyers. Forget about any of that. That's what you do first. So I think this phenomena, I don't know how else to describe it, of sexual abuse by clergy and religious leadership, and the even more terrible response by the leaders, from popes to church ushers, has revealed some deadly faults in the communities. The victims of abuse, their loved ones and their supporters, by their courageous and by their always risky witness, are leading the way for all of us to repair the damage and to make our Christian communities, our churches, look and act like what they claim to be. May the Lord of peace be in your homes and be with you always. Thank you.